my advice to you is to do your due diligence. Be your own advocate. Don't be bullied by your healthcare professional. You're hiring them, they're not hiring you. And if they fire you because you're not adhering to a certain childhood schedule, then adios. Go find someone that has a little more scrutiny and will accommodate you, because it's you're the patient, or your child is the patient.
Hello, critical thinkers. Welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, and today we are speaking with Dr. Lynn Finn, who is really a warrior for truth and an absolute perfect fit for the show. So, Dr. Finn, welcome to Healthy and Awake podcast.
Thank you, Mike, for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Now, if you don't mind, I know just before recording, you mentioned how you like to keep it low key. Some of my audience might not know who you are. So would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you do?
Sure. I'm a retired infectious disease specialist. I did come out of retirement when COVID started for obvious reasons. People needed help and they weren't getting it. So that kind of woke me up. I'm not completely out of medicine because I've now focused mostly on clinical research. I develop therapeutics. I know when therapeutics are being developed in a poor manner, when cherry-picked data proves a wrong endpoint and all of that stuff. So currently I'm with the IMA, which is the Independent Health Alliance. I'm one of the fellows, and I review a lot of the studies, and we're now coming out with our first unbiased, unbought journal, medical journal. So it's really, we're really doing some great things there at IMA. It's formerly the FLCCC, if you've heard of it. We're also working very deeply with the new administration's HHS. So as far as I'm concerned, I've spent the last 5 years trying to speak truth to what's going on. I've pretty much traveled all around the world with esteemed colleagues that are also in the same boat, getting lambasted for having critical minds. And, you know, we continue on because there's a right and there's a wrong, and none of us can continue the wrong way. That's for sure. So that's my story.
Yeah, that's very cool. And when I was reading up on some of your work, I saw a term that came up that we've discussed previously on the show with Dr. Jack Cruz, and it is decentralized medicine.
Yeah.
And so I really got excited when I read that. So what does that mean to you, and what's that been like in your world?
I mean, decentralized medicine is pretty much critical thought. It's a doctor-patient relationship that requires individual thinking and individual solutions rather than being dictated how and why and when to do whatever. It's the same thing that I preach about with scientific journals. They're so centralized. The whole peer review process is so distorted, so bastardized that it becomes, you know, the loudest person is the dimmest. And it became more like what I call PAL review, where, you know, if you're the right person and you're part of the club, and it's not what it was intended for. I mean, with decentralized medical publications, we're talking about putting all the data and methodology out there so anyone can go on the bench, reproduce it, and get the same results. And if you can reproduce those results doing the same methodology the same way, then that's verification that you have solid science. But nobody does that anymore, because peer review really is a bunch of your buddies trying to read through something and saying, hey, you know, you didn't put this statement in there, and we need that statement in there in order for it to get published. Which is why you'll read a lot about, say, the mRNA vaccines. You'll see it, you know, outline a detriment, a really serious adverse event. But the whole the whole mantra of the paper is, but vaccines are the way to do it, and they save lives, and this is safe and effective. So, you know, you have to kiss the ring, you have to say the password, and all these other things. And that's what centralized science is about. And the same thing goes in medicine, centralized medicine. What happened during COVID? You've had all these guidelines, and then they incentivized those who followed the guidelines. Well, then just get a vending machine. Who needs a, you know, if you ever seen Idiocracy, you know, put this in your mouth and this in your butt or whatever, put this, you know, that's where we're headed. And, you know, with AI and with, you know, flow charts, there's no thought involved anymore. And it's the one size fits all routine that just doesn't help anybody. It's bad for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. You know, to hear more and more of this talk on decentralized health and medicine, it really does get me excited for the future, because I was first woken up to this in 2012 when I read a book called Pharmageddon by Dr. David Healy.
Yeah.
And he talks in great detail about ghostwriting and pharmaceutical influence in the studies and statistical manipulation and really the epitome of centralization in publications. And I love how you made the distinction there between centralized medicine and centralized publications as well, because those are two distinct things. And so hopefully we see more and more doctors catching on to this, because the system is clearly broken.
Well, it truly is. And with the advent of AI, you hear it pushed in every aspect of our lives now. Well, what does AI do? It gathers information that's out there. So when you completely pad all of the scientific information with falsehoods, or like I said, statements that may not reflect the data, that's what AI is going to pick up. So you already start with a faulty foundation, and you're going to get faulty results. And all you're going to do is have a narrative, and nobody wants that. So, and when you're talking about decentralized medicine, I think our first step into decentralizing medicine has already happened, at least among family practitioners and pediatricians, doing something called DPC, which is direct care. And direct care removes them from the hospital affiliation, because the hospital affiliation is what puts a thumb on you to have to abide by their rules, their guidelines, and their everything. And then you're not a practitioner anymore. You're just basically an automaton.
Yeah.
So DPC and you know, an organization I belong to, which is AAPS, American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, is very big on DPC. And if you go to their website, which is aapsonline.org, you can find a host of independent practitioners that are board certified, that see patients, but they don't have that hospital affiliation to cloud their judgment or to change what they do. Oftentimes they'll have subscriptions where you can just join a subscription and get all the care you need, which kind of bypasses the whole insurance thing, right? Or you can pay fee per service, but they're very, very transparent about what things cost. And that's what we've been lacking in medicine all of this time. And, you know, between the insurance companies and hospitals, things get pretty pricey pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'm seeing this explosion of medical doctors leaving hospitals to open up concierge medicine. A lot of doctors that I know and work with in some cases. So there is clearly a frustration from the medical staff as well with this broken system. And I do feel for the doctors in there, because I really do believe, you know, most of the doctors, look, there's plenty of idiot doctors out there, as you and I know, who pushed a lot of really risky things over the past few years. But I've spoken with enough doctors to know that I think most of them are pretty good. And the ones that aren't doing as much good as they would like to are, as you described, stuck in this system of the hospital where they basically have to follow all the rules. They can only think within the scope of what the hospital really allows them, because it's constrained by protocols. And so it is messy right now. But
Barry,
you also brought up AI. I was going to bring this up later, but maybe we should just get into it now. I'm obsessed with AI. I really am. I was talking about it before ChatGPT existed. And so I see the good and bad. And it's funny because when it comes up on the show, it's always like the risks are brought up as you did. I think that's fair. I guess my question is, do you see any potential good? Because it sounded like...
Oh, absolutely. There's tons of good. I mean, doing reviews and diving deep into what is out there, there's so much potential for AI. I mean, we use it every day. Everybody does. And as it becomes more nuanced, it'll become even more helpful. But in the AI race, it's become evident that the powers that be want to control a narrative. And in doing so, look at how much money over the last 5 years went into laying down a narrative that something that should not be on the market is safe and effective and should be in every arm. And because they laid out so much scientific publications, so many papers, so many false narratives, that's what AI is going to run with.
Right.
And, you know, even on Grok, which is the X AI, we are literally teaching it. We're pulling out publications that it does not consider, but should consider because they mimic what we're seeing clinically. And we're feeding it with that. And it's starting to come around on certain things. And I think that's going to be key in order to keep AI honest, is we're going to have to insert the nuances that are so important in coming up with a conclusion in order for it to actually be helpful and accurate. But there is a definite race to try to lay out information as soon as possible to set the narrative.
I see a sort of mirror problem with AI that you just laid out in health and medicine, and that is centralization. Because all the tools we use right now are, you know, OpenAI, which is, I think, heavily controlled by Microsoft, XAI, heavily controlled by Elon, who has actually openly said he thinks mRNA platforms are the future of medicine. He said something like that. So,
yeah, I think he's changing his mind a little bit about that, having witnessed so much injury around him. But he did say that. He did say that. And many people did. And the very thing they're saying is going to be revolutionary in cancer is actually causing cancer. So, you know, a lot of things they didn't think about when discovering this platform and pushing it out the way they did. And they did so under duress. And I think that was intentional, because then there's 77 other things in trials right now on the very same platform that should never go into a human. So I agree with you regarding AI's ability to serve. I mean, it certainly helps. Let's say you're doing payroll or you're doing your accounting. I mean, there's so much it can help with. In the same vein, that's how many people is going to put out of work. And what are you going to do with everybody? Right? That's a big, big issue. And I don't think there's any getting around it, because that's where we're headed. The question is, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to manage it?
That's why one of the reasons I spend so much time thinking about it, because when I was writing about AI before ChatGPT existed, I was warning my health coaching colleagues, saying, look, this technology is going to be used to replace us. And
absolutely,
still to this day, nobody believes it, because all the health coaches I work with are 20 years older than me. And they just, you know, I think they're still trying to adjust to this tech. And so I said, like, look, I've known this is coming. I've been preparing for a decade and we're watching it unfold. And it brings up some interesting ethical considerations, because on one hand, I think you're entirely correct. What's the criteria used to train this? Because you can train it on false data, and then it's basically a powerhouse to falsely train or coach people with wrong information. On the other hand, if you can maybe in a decentralized fashion create some kind of AI that was more decentralized and based in fact and had the ability to critically think like we do, then I think it's like, well, if we can cheaply coach or doctor people with this AI way faster than we could with human beings, and it could be potentially more accurate than human beings, then isn't there kind of a responsibility to apply this sort of technology.
Ethically, there's a responsibility to give the best care and the best options possible for your patients or your clients, no doubt. In the same vein, you're also contributing to your own extinction. So you have to find that happy medium where it becomes a tool for you, but cannot replace you.
Right, right. That's why I try to really let my personality shine through on the show, because, people like to work with people they like. And
for sure. That's why, I'm retired. So if I'm a curmudgeon, I'm working about it. They want to hear from me because they know that I might have some insight that isn't generally being influenced by anyone or anything. And I can't be bought. So there's that.
People see that and they recognize it. And honestly, even someone like Dr. Jack Cruz, he's one of the biggest jerks I know on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. He's a jerk, but he's a solid guy.
He's been on the show twice. I'm his biggest fan. And I think it just shows how if you're really speaking truth and keeping it real, those moments that might rub people the wrong way, I think still
they're inevitable. They're inevitable, but, they're still acceptable if it's for the right reasons, I think.
Yeah. I want to ask you a bit of a weird question, because I know with your expertise, you've maybe heard this before. You see online, viruses aren't real. COVID has never been isolated in a lab.
It has.
And, people like to take these things and run with them. And we're trying to figure out the truth on this show. It sounds a little silly to me, but what's your take?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not silly that people have arrived at that potential question. And it's mainly, I think, because of the past. How do you regain trust from people when public health is so disjointed? How do you regain trust in medicine when you have, all of these physicians injecting three mRNA vaccines into a baby before it's 1 year old? Where do you go from here? And I get that if you look as far back as the 1980s when Fauci was first installed, and you see that they made a definite declaration that HIV is a causative agent for AIDS and that nothing else could have caused the immunodeficiency syndromes, and that it was caused by a virus. But yet when someone's in full-blown AIDS, you can't find the virus in their bloodstream through electron microscopy. So then you're like, do viruses exist? I know that question came back then with David Resnick and Peter Duesberg. But Peter Duesberg knows viruses exist. He worked with the retroviruses most of his career. But I can see why people would question them because of a situation like that, where if you have someone in full-blown disease, you should find virus in their blood, period. You should be able to find the virus. But they couldn't. So then the question became, do viruses exist? The answer is yes, they do exist. They're proteins that can cause an immune response and a biological activity in the human body. It's a foreign protein. It's not self. So it mounts an immune response. And that can manifest as symptoms of inflammation, of complement cascade, and all of the things that happen when you're faced with a foreign protein. So do they exist? They absolutely do exist. But I don't get angry at the questions, because I do see in the past where people were tricked, and because of that, they think they throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it's much more nuanced than that. Did an HIV retrovirus exist? Yes, it did. Did they spend millions of dollars to get it to finally infect a monkey because it wouldn't before then? Yes, they did. So the term gain of function came about, which was really dual use. They used dual use to get away with it, but it's really changing the virus to make it more transmissible, to make it more virulent in the host of choice, or to make it adapt to a host of choice. Those sort of things are artificially done. They're done through engineering in a laboratory by humans. And they shouldn't be done, in my opinion. I know people love to make the argument that if we can figure out the potential, we can, you know, heat it off before it happens. But no, we're actually facilitating the potential.
It sounds like weaponization.
It is. And that's a fact. And it should be regulated, and it's not. And that is insane.
Hey, have you noticed how broken conventional medicine is? And it only treats symptoms instead of solving root problems. I mean, it's no wonder more people than ever struggle with chronic health issues, stubborn weight gain, low energy, and plenty more challenges. Actually, here's how Mike, a client of mine at Avantia Health Optimization, feels about our hyper-personalized approach.
Number one, you save me focus of attention. I have other things that are pressing and pending. I no longer have the playing time. So I need somebody to help me get the information I need specifically. You're saving me hours upon hours of time, but you're also saving me the youthfulness and clarity you have of cutting through the chase. So you have saved me time, financial money, the thinking, and the labor, the intense labor, and that is worth all the money in the world.
So as most of you know, I'm Mike Vera, board-certified health and wellness coach, host of Healthy and Awake podcast, and founder of Avantia Health Optimization. We deliver hyper-personalized coaching, addressing lifestyle as the missing link. Whether you're battling chronic health challenges, aiming for sustainable weight loss, or you're a busy executive or athlete needing peak performance, I'm your guy. Your first session is just $1, so you can try out health coaching, get a feel for it, and you can visit AvantiaHealthOptimization.com or visit the link in the show notes. So check out Avantia, because your health deserves solutions that truly work for you.
But my point, going back to that question of do viruses exist, they exist. Are they as horrible as portrayed? They're everywhere. We face them all the time. Our immune system fights them all the time. It's not a big deal. But when you alter them, when you change their whole binding and their whole adaptation and their increase their transmissibility and all of these things, it becomes more of a challenge. And that's where the questioning comes in. People say, there's no way that, you know, this can leak out of a lab and cause this much destruction. If you make it transmissible, it'll become more transmissible. If you make it more virulent, it can be more virulent. If it was never in a human before, you can make it through serial passage. You can speed up evolution by thousands of years in a blink. And that's where I think the problem is. And though people may disagree that viruses don't exist, they in fact do. Electron microscopy is the gold standard for identifying viruses. However, in clinical practice, we've learned to identify them based on symptomology, how you present. And if you present with a battery of symptoms that someone can easily tell it's a single-stranded RNA virus, doesn't matter which one. Is it influenza? Is it a coronavirus? Is it an adenovirus? Whichever one it is, they can be treated the same way. So it doesn't really matter. The whole point is to get you from behind the eight ball and have your immune system fight it and move on. Then you're immune. And the whole idea of then pushing the natural immunity doesn't matter thing with COVID was a first for everybody. You know, you're telling someone who's fully immune because they're recovered to go get a synthetic gene injection because their immune system isn't enough. And that's crazy. That has never been the case in human history. Once you're over a virus, you have the most complete immunity to that virus than you could get. There's no other way around it. And adding to it only suppresses your immune system or sends it into dysregulation. So, yeah. to those people who question viruses, I'm all for it. Question things. Have a good answer. There are good answers. There's concrete evidence. Some people say, oh, those aren't viruses. They're exosomes. And they're not exosomes. Exosomes do not have a surface protein that allows them to attach. They don't. You can see the difference. You know the difference. But going back to the 80s and the 90s when they demonized a specific retrovirus that they couldn't even produce in a full-blown patient, that I think planted the seed for I don't think viruses exist. And rightfully so. Yeah, I'm not mad at them. I just try to reason with them.
I have to say, I think that's one of the favorite answers I've ever gotten on the show when I ask the question, because I really love the attitude of a healthy sense of skepticism, you know, because many doctors, my God, that's ridiculous. Like, why even bother with that question? You're saying, I love the questions. Keep asking
I
the questions.
I do. Keep asking them. I mean, if you know everything, then you can say, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. I hate everything. But if you understand that the more you know, the less you really know, then you're always encouraging skepticism. I mean, that's what scientific discourse is all about. That's what the debate is all about. And though the person you're debating may not have as much education in it as you, there are ways to bridge it. There are ways to bridge the ideas and have the discussion. And, you know, the fact in the last 5 years that scientific discourse was completely shut down, I was censored on Twitter 10 times. I was banned. I came up with 10 different accounts. And, you know, as soon as I said something that was accurate, I was banned again. So everything I was banned for turned out to be factual. Shocker. But anyway, that's why they kind of wanted to, that's when I knew that they wanted to grasp the 1941 idea of a unified message. And, you know, nobody wins from a unified message, because all you're getting is somebody's narrative dictated to you. And there's no discourse involved. So when that's cut off and it's not allowed anymore, then you should panic.
Yeah. Well, I guess along those lines, when people are talking about are viruses even real, they love to say, you need to learn about germ theory versus terrain theory as if it's one or the other, and it's
not,
has to be one.
Yeah,
but,
they're
not. But based on your answer, it sounds like it's a mix of both.
It is a mix of both. I mean, if you optimize your immune system, if you have enough vitamin D, if your microbiome is where it should be, if you're eating healthy, all of these things, and getting enough sleep, then you're prepared more than most to handle a pathogen. And that's your terrain. And if you don't prepare your terrain and you eat garbage and you lack bifidobacteria and your vitamin D levels are below 10, all of these things put you behind the eight ball, then your terrain is not so good. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a pathogen that you're exposed to that puts you in that deficit. So they don't have to be mutually exclusive. Germ theory is real. I have worked on the bench for decades. I have isolated not only viruses, bacteria, I have injected them into rabbits and created the disease and all of Koch's postulates. Koch's postulates have trouble in viruses, mainly because viruses don't have the machinery to replicate on their own like bacteria do. Viruses need a cell, a human host or an animal host or some sort of machinery to hijack and take over, which is why I actually call the gene shot that they rolled out, it's really a virus. And it is, because it's taking over your machinery to produce the pathogen, which is the spike protein. So it's no different than a virus. And there's no shutoff switch. That's even the crazier part. But they do not have to be mutually exclusive. And I think that's the big crux of the argument. Terrain is a theory that is valid. So is germ theory.
Yeah, and earlier you mentioned HIV. I've seen some suspicious activity around Lyme disease and COVID. And it really makes you wonder how many of these viruses that we do face have been engineered. And it really makes you think. I know it's stepping into that conspiracy theory territory, but...
Well, when it, you're conspiracy theories are proven correct time after time. You start, you know, realizing that the term itself is meant to discredit, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. What means something are the facts. And I know they play with Ebola. I know they play with, you know, Lassa. They play with dengue. They mess around with, you know, hantavirus and Lyme and everything else.
A lot in Africa, too. I mean, if people find it hard to believe that it would happen here, go read a book. Go read Target Africa and see how they experiment on people in Africa where they can get away with it with little to no repercussions.
Well, I'll tell you, Tony Fauci did that in the 80s. He was doing a dose-ranging tox study of nevirapine, probably, which is AZT, really. So AZT, the most toxic compound to ever be put in a human in history. And he was doing dose-ranging toxicity trials in pregnant women here in the U.S. until Mrs. Halpern died and her baby was born injured, and enough came out regarding that he had to stop doing it in the U.S. So what did he do? He took Deborah Birx, and with the clearance of his wife in ethics, and he went and bought the Ugandan government to do it in pregnant Ugandan women. So, you know, we're no angels.
Yeah.
They've done this for a long time, and they continue to do it. And Bill Gates, along with others, who, by the way, is not a scientist, continues to do it as well, because apparently money can buy anything.
Well, here's an easy question, perfectly in line with that. Do you think Fauci should be arrested? And if so, why?
That's being very nice. That's a very nice way to handle it. I'll just say that. And why 45 years of being one of the most prolific serial killers in history? That's my take. That is my opinion. You don't have to agree with it. An institution doesn't have to back it. It's a fact.
Well, I do have a lot of doctors who listen to the show just because they love to challenge me, and they hate some of the things that I say. They hate my sense of skepticism and challenging the status quo. So what about those doctors who are listening in and hearing this idea that Fauci being arrested is going easy on him? Like, what do you think would convince those doctors that Fauci is not the good guy he appears to be on TV?
I don't know, maybe a conversation with Ms. Halpern before she died and her skin completely necrosed off her body and her liver turned black and she passed away with a baby in her womb. Maybe walking through some of the AIDS wards in the 80s where they were forbidden to be treated with Bactrim for their pneumocystis pneumonia, which would have turned them around. Sound familiar? Hospitals were forbidden to use
Paxlovid.
Well, no, not Paxlovid. Doctors were forbidden to use Bactrim, which would have turned them around. Like, they were forbidden to use hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin for COVID and told to go home and wait until you couldn't breathe, then go to the hospital. Which, since when do we let a disease advance to the point of no return only to then look to treat them? That's the most insane thing. When we have so many drugs out there proven safe that could mitigate a lot of the symptoms and turn people around. And that's what happened back then. Let those doctors walk through these wards where they were refused something that would have turned them around and instead given AZT, which is the most toxic drug ever to be used. It's like forever being on the most toxic chemotherapeutic agent till you're dead.
That's why I mentioned Paxlovid, because I think that kind of mirrors the AZT, right? Where they were.
It actually does. So did remdesivir in that
right.
Where they were. I really scrutinized the study for remdesivir because I knew of its history with Ebola and how ineffective it was and the adverse events in both the kidneys and the liver. And I couldn't understand why they would roll it out for a mild respiratory disease. And when I looked at the trial, it literally mirrored the AZT trial where midway through, they saw that there was a high level of adverse events and poor outcomes. And instead of halting it like they should have, he changed some of the endpoints, changed the duration of the study, removed the word death as an outcome, and then made the data look a little more favorable so it could get put through. And you can see the history of changes. If you look on clinicaltrials.gov and you look up remdesivir, you can see the history of changes and you can see when they were made. And it's like a fingerprint. You know exactly what happened. And it's the same thing he did back in during HIV times with the AZT. So I knew that was a drug to stay away from for sure. And it very much mirrored that. And Paxlovid, as well as molnupiravir, same thing. Molnupiravir was developed at Emory University many years ago. Tax dollars developed that drug. It was a poor drug. It's mutagenic. It causes mutation of the pathogen in real time. It forces evolution in a way that we don't want it to be. And none of those drugs, the Paxlovids or the molnupiravirs, were effective. And they caused more harm than good. But they pushed them through as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're patented. They can say safe and effective. They can charge a boatload of money for it. I know if a hospital used remdesivir, they reimburse 20% of the entire hospital bill. I mean, this entire so-called pandemic was incentivized. So, of course, you're going to get, you know, no one testing for the flu. You should get money for a positive flu test. You get money for a positive COVID test. And I'm going to keep testing you till it turns positive. There's just so much involved. But for those doctors listening that think, you know, everything is of pure heart and done scientifically, you really need to look back and start uncovering some of the things from the past. And you'll see that so many people have been played for a long time. And our medical schools are infiltrated as well. So we're turning out more of the same thinkers instead of anybody that questions. I have a colleague that would encourage her medical students to question, and she was laid off.
What?
Yeah. Of course, that was Washington State, but, you know, still.
Wow. That's
where we're going.
Wow. That is really, that, I don't even know how to wrap my head around that. Mm-hmm. Ask questions and they lay them off. You know, people are supposed to trust their doctors. They want to trust their doctors, and the information they're getting is clearly compromised. And with these drugs, they go, oh, well, the FDA has approved remdesivir. And, you know, look at the history of drugs that have been pulled. In addition to the fact that the information the doctors are getting is compromised, it's, you know, people really, really need to have that healthy sense of skepticism to protect their health. It's one of the healthiest things you can do.
Absolutely.
You mentioned some of the other early treatment protocols like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. I've been reading a lot from Dr. William Makis. I don't know if you've been following him at all, who's been treating.
Makis, a friend of mine. Yeah.
Makis. Okay. So he, for anyone who doesn't know, he seems to be effectively treating cancer patients using a protocol of high dose ivermectin and fenbendazole. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
Fenbendazole. Well, that's the animal version. The human version is mebendazole. They're anti-Helminth type drugs, but they also have other activity against tumor cells. He's seeing some positive outcomes. It's not a golden pill. It's not. I don't want everyone to think, oh, to hell with my protocol. I'm going on fenbendazole and ivermectin, and I'm going to cure my stage 4 cancer. They do have activity. They do help with other medications, and they can be very effective in certain cancers. Not all cancers are the same. You got to think of each different cancer as a different disease, because they are. They have different markers. They have different cells. They have different infiltrative properties. Some are more metastatic, some are not. Some have mets to the brain and the liver and can kill you quicker. Some are found in late stage, some are found in early stage. There are so many different aspects of cancer that to even say that, you know, it's a golden pill is just, it's a setup for disappointment. Is he seeing some really amazing results with them? Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are some great turnarounds, particularly in those cancers that are suspected to have been brought on by the mRNA therapies, because these people are producing spike. We're seeing spike, you know, 1,500 days after their first injection, still circulating in their bodies. That puts your body in a state of, you know, hyperinflammation for that long. What's going to happen? You know, that's a cancer waiting to happen. And in situations like that, where we're seeing late stage aggressive cancer diagnoses, those that are suspected to have been brought on by mRNA seem to do better on these protocols that William is working with. And, you know, you'll find a lot of oncologists have their patients come to them and say, what about fenbendazole? What about mebendazole and ivermectin? And they say, no, absolutely not. Do that. Well, they don't interact. There's no drug-to-drug interact with chemo or biologicals and these medications. Just know that first. If they're telling you not to use them, oftentimes it's because they've enrolled you into a study. And if you're in a study, you have to be medically naive to other therapeutics. Otherwise,
control the variables.
You have to control it. And of course, as the patient has to assign to informed consent. So the patient knows they're in a study. And if they're in a study, they can't use that protocol. So their doctor might put the kibosh on something like that. But if they're not in a study and they're going through the typical, say, protocol for pancreatic cancer or the typical protocol for, say, prostate cancer, taking these meds isn't going to affect their regular protocols in a negative way. So I don't think they should worry about that. We've seen PSAs drop immensely with ivermectin, vitamin C, avastatin, mebendazole, and a lot of these different drugs. And it's interesting to test them in these ways to find out what's reactive and what cancers. But again, I want to be very clear. It's not a golden pill. Just because you get on it doesn't mean your cancer is going to be cured. Cancer is very methodic, stepwise, and it's a beast. It's a beast based on, you know, your genetics and your lifestyle. First thing I tell people to do with a cancer diagnosis is go on a keto diet or a carnivore diet, depending upon what cancer it is, and cut out the carbs, cut out the sugars. That's first and foremost. Intermittent fasting, great for apoptosis, great for autophagy to burst some of those cells. Same thing with spike, those that are still circulating spike. Intermittent fasting, supervised 3-day or 5-day fasting, those kind of things can encourage autophagy. And that's kind of what you want to do, is have some of these cells carrying the spike to be removed from your body. And the same thing goes with cancer. So there are a lot of different mechanisms involved. There are a lot of different ways to attack it. The best way is to see someone that is experienced in that particular cancer. And like I said, kudos to William for doing so much for so many. Some people don't have the intention of taking chemotherapeutics. They never wanted to, they never will. And that's that. So for those people, it can be quite helpful. But, you know, it's such a complex disease.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing that stood out to, I mean, a lot of things stood out to me there, but one thing in particular is how some people might be told not to take it because they're on a study already and they want to control for confounding variables. And yet I see all these anecdotal stories online of people experimenting on their own. And it makes me wonder how many of those studies that doctors are trying to control for are actually confounded from people experimenting on their own.
Well, it does make you wonder, but in the same vein of what you're saying, what has been a huge concern of mine is those that have received mRNA, whether it's two, whether it's three, whether it's seven, those people that are enrolled in a study are going to have different outcomes as well. They're going to have different AE profiles. They're going to have different outcomes, different variables that aren't included in the study that you're trying to study for, which is why a lot of the studies that I'm working on right now, I try to use it as an exclusion criteria. If you were vaccinated, it's going to be next to impossible to enroll large studies that way. But at the very least, you have to do screenings to find out if they have any hint of vaccine injury, because that is going to affect your outcome. It's going to affect the outcome of pretty much every clinical study going forward.
Well, I know a lot of people are optimistic now that RFK Jr. is officially in place, the MAHA movement. I also know a lot of people are skeptical. When I spoke to Dr. Bowden, she expressed some skepticism on MAHA. Dr. Jack Cruz, same thing. What's your take?
Well, since we're all part of the same group and we talk probably every day, I know where the skepticism is coming from. It appeared almost inorganically that forces arrived to chronic illness be caused by food additives and dyes and stuff like that. And that kind of, after 4 years of us getting the word out about this gene therapy and how it was pushed through in a poor manner, I'm trying to choose my words carefully, all of a sudden the focus became on Fruit Loops and food dyes and things that we have a choice in not purchasing, versus putting something on a childhood schedule that pediatricians are putting in every 6-month-old. So
the mean siblings had a big role in popularizing these ideas too.
Yeah, out of nowhere. And yes, we have all had this discussion, Jack and myself and Mary. And it's concerning because it's a deflection of sorts, and it takes the focus off of what we've been working on for so long. And, you know, I see through it, but it doesn't mean that both can't happen. That's why we're not quiet about it. Doesn't mean just because we remove or focus on certain things in our food supply. At first, I thought, you know what? They're sacrificing big food for big pharma. And I'm probably right about that. And if you look who is involved, the chief of staff at the White House is involved with, you know, was involved with PR for pharma. The means, they're involved with pharma between 23andMe with Casey, and then Callie with his PR work and lobbying in the past. So obviously they're a bit compromised in that respect. If that means we get some bad foods removed and put, you know, lard and beef tallow back in and take the vegetable oils out, I'm all for it. I'm here for it. I have no problem with that. But I'm not going to stop the quest to remove bad therapeutics from our schedules. And that's basically not going to stop. We're going to keep fighting for that. And hopefully, just like with Terrain and viral theory, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both.
Yeah. And I think it's totally fair, the skepticism against the MAHA movement, because you laid it out perfectly. I mean, we just have not seen what a lot of us were hoping for. And I think there's still time and opportunity for that to happen. I think if it is going to happen, it's something that has to be done very carefully and strategically, because people are going to freak out when they realize how they've been fooled, if they accept it at all.
If they accept it at all. Yeah.
So it's incredibly complex, and hopefully we do see, you know, we get what we've really been pushing for the past several years, thanks to your efforts and many other brave doctors like yourself. I know we're close to time here, and I have a million more questions. So hopefully we could do a part two, but I want to be respectful of your time. So let's end with this. You know, there's a lot of people out there who, as we said, want to trust their doctors. And then there's also doctors who are maybe stuck in the system. What advice do you have for the people and the doctors?
To the doctors, I'd say kind of reflect on yourself and find out why you really got into medicine. And if you revert back to the real reason why you got into medicine, there are ways that you can achieve that. There are ways that you can network with other physicians with the same ideas. There are ways you can go to direct care. There are organizations out there that you can join so you don't feel like an island. I know a lot of people went with the flow because they would be completely ostracized. Nobody wants to be ostracized. And they would feel like they're alone. And all of that training and all of that money and all of that time would be for naught. But you're not alone. We have huge networks of physicians who said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm going to find a way to still complete my mission for my patients, and that is to make them healthier, not make them perpetually ill. And there are ways to do that. So look into DPC, look into even changing your specialty if you need to. There are so many ways to reinvent yourself, but I would say connect with others. IMA, some of the senior fellows at IMA, Global COVID Summit, you know who they are out there. Connect with them. They'll put you with the right people. AAPS is a great organization. More are popping up every day. So to those doctors, you're not alone. So if that helps you decide that it's not as scary to venture out as you think it is, you might lose some friends in the process. That's part of it. But then you got to ask yourself, are those the kind of friends I want? Are those really my friends? And to the patients, do your due diligence and find a physician that listens. Find one that is out for you, not out for their hospital protocol or their a lot of these health groups that you have to, you know, follow what they do. There are physicians in every city and every state. I would suggest going to aapsonline.org and look in your state and find out who those independent physicians are, because they're going to be the ones to build a relationship with. There are others out there as well. If you want to telehealth, there's Gold Care, there's My Free Doctor. There are a lot of different groups that want to help where the personal physicians turn their backs on their patients in the past 5 years. So my advice to you is to do your due diligence, be your own advocate. Don't be bullied by your healthcare professional. You're hiring them, they're not hiring you. And if they fire you because you're not adhering to a certain childhood schedule, then adios. Go find someone that has a little more scrutiny and will accommodate you, because it's you're the patient or your child is the patient. So do your due diligence. They're out there. Don't throw everybody in the same basket, because we're not all created equal.
And you're proof that they're out there, right? You're a medical doctor, and the easy thing to do would be to go with the flow, whatever the system says. And here you are, you know, really you putting your career on the line to speak the truth. And I thank you for that. I know my audience thanks you for that. Dr. Lynn Finn, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, you can follow us on what was Twitter, X, IMA, which is Honest Medicine, at Honest Medicine. Our group is very, very connected and working closely with HHS. We are starting our own medical journal, our own scientific journal. We have a host of international fellows all over the world that are solid, trustworthy, and honest physicians. You can also find me on X at Finderella1. That was my seventh account that was reinstated thanks to Elon pushing for a little bit of free speech. I also have a Telegram channel, which is the same, Lynn Finn. And you can catch me on a lot of podcasts, a lot of stages all over the world, and I'll just keep speaking the truth.
Well, thank you for doing that. I'm going to put all the links in the show notes, so folks, be sure to check that out. Dr. Finn, thanks again so much. And folks, stay healthy, stay awake.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple. Or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.